The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, I'm Stefan Fatsis, and this is Slate's sports podcast. Hang up and listen for the week of September 25th, 2017. On this week's show, we will discuss the remarkable weekend in sports in which the president of the United States called for firing athletes who engage in peaceful sanctioned protest, and the athletes and their employers responded in force. Then we'll stick to some sports, more or less, and explore the psyche of Golden State Warriors star Kevin Durant, who tweeted intemperately, undercover, in the third person, about his former team and coach. Finally, one-time U.S. men's national team defender Marcelo Balboa will be here to talk about Atlanta United, the Major League Soccer expansion team that is drawing record crowds and crazy fan support. I am joined by Josh Levine. He is Slate's editorial director. He's not in the studio. Hi, Josh.
Hey, Stefan.
Also with us is Marcus Thompson, making a return appearance to the podcast. He is now a senior columnist for The Athletic. What's up, Marcus?
I'm sure you have subscribed already. Thank you very much.
I have, as a matter of fact. We've also done a segment about The Athletic with the great Ken Rosenthal. We are all wishing you luck. On Friday night in Alabama, Donald Trump decided to comment on the protests against police brutality and for racial justice that took off last year after Colin Kaepernick took a knee. I was going to play a clip of Trump labeling NFL players who had protested, almost all of them black, sons of bitches, or of him calling for fans to walk out of games where players silently protest, in other words, to boycott the league. But frankly, I can't listen to them anymore. They make me sick. Instead, let us focus on what happened on Saturday and Sunday. More than 150 NFL players, black and white, took a knee or sat down during the anthem. LaShawn McCoy, who the day before tweeted, "It's really sad, man. Our president is an asshole." LaShawn McCoy stretched, and hundreds more linked arms. Coaches and owners participated. Three full teams stayed in the locker room. A Major League Baseball player knelt, the first one to ever do so. Two anthem singers knelt. At the WNBA Finals, the Los Angeles Sparks didn't come out for the anthem, and neither did players on two teams in the National Women's Soccer League. There were dozens of statements issued over the weekend. Some were eloquent and moving and righteous. Some were perfunctory and weak. Marcus, Trump certainly managed to turn kneeling into a protest against him. Did the events of this weekend do more, do you think?
Oh, I think they did. Seeing the Jacksonville Jaguars owner on the sideline locking arms just – it's like, oh man, this is real. If the NFL owners who directly supported the campaign of Donald Trump is like, hold on, dude, chill. If Roger Goodell has to send a statement, and we all know Roger Goodell, like, you know, he's not trying to be the responsible one. If he's like, all right, you've gone too far, then you know we have something here. And just watching everybody, Ray Lewis is on the sidelines kneeling. He on two knees. You know something big has happened here when Ray Lewis, who was ripping the whole thing, now is like on his knees praying. Like, this is crazy. It's amazing that the president was able to do this in a way. And in a sense, it's almost commendable that he could be so derogatory as to get former friends, to his former friends against him. That it's just crazy.
The thing that was really notable about Sunday is that, you know, Colin Kaepernick wasn't there. Jelani Cobb of The New Yorker was saying on Twitter that this is the ending of the Colin Kaepernick movie. This is like where the swelling music comes in and his protest, you know, takes over the whole NFL and the whole country. But there's something a little bit off about the fact that the folks that blackballed Kaepernick are now being celebrated as heroes, in a sense, that Trump has made it so that in order to show our disgust with him, we need to support this league that has not covered itself in glory with respect to, both Kaepernick and these protests and a whole lot of other issues. What do you make of that, Stefan?
I completely agree with that. I'm looking at the notes I wrote before the show, and that is exactly one of the points I wanted to make. There are two things here. One is that, yeah, these statements from NFL owners and front offices, and, you know, Dan Snyder was linking arms with players during the national anthem too. And Dan Snyder is, believe me, not someone that we want to praise for his progressive beliefs and stances. I feel like we're giving these guys cover for their previous behaviors. Let us not forget, Colin Kaepernick still does not have a job. And Colin Kaepernick still, despite all of these statements from almost every NFL team, some of them great, some of them progressive, some of them thoughtful, some ass covering, despite all of those statements, this guy's still out of work. This guy was blackballed.
And he's going to be out of work. And they're going to lean on pig socks and Castro shirts because it's really not about doing the right thing. It never has been. And furthermore, it's never even about the conversation Kaepernick was trying to start. And the hypocrisy in all of it is that in the end, they just want to sell tickets, right? We don't want a distraction. Meanwhile, there's no Kaepernick, and now you have even more distraction. The NFL has long been exposed for being hypocritical, money-hungry, self-indulgent, unrighteousness, right? Just the modicum for big business that is shady, and that's not going to change. However, they do have an opportunity, because if somebody signs Kaepernick tomorrow, it's like, man, my bad, we blew it. Come play with us. Come play with us, Cap. And if they were smart, I'm sending out the notice tomorrow, today. Like, hey, can somebody please sign Cap? Like, this is the last thing we got here. If we sign Cap right now, we at least save a little face. And they've shown they can survive saving less face than that.
Look, they didn't. The owners really didn't have much option here, right? They have to appear sympathetic and in opposition to.
I mean, Cass didn't even show up to the anthem. They didn't even show up to the anthem, and NFL was like, "Okay, we're not going to fine you." Like that's how far we've got. Where the Steelers are like, "Yeah, we're cool. We're just not going to do it at all." And they're like, "Yeah, all right, we got you. We understand."
And the Seahawks and the Titans right? did the same thing, and they were playing each
that's
other.
That's automatic fine right there. That any other time, that's like fine statement. They're like, "All right, we understand. It's all good."
A couple of points here. I think the fact that the NFL, who it seems like we're all in agreement, is not an organization that you would ever consider progressive. The fact that they, you know, the owners and the commissioner's office came out in support of players this strongly after Trump attacked them, doesn't that show just how amazingly awful and craven the ESPN response was after Jemele Hill got attacked? That ESPN couldn't come out and say, we don't necessarily support what she said, but we support her right to say it. And there's no way in hell that the president is going to tell us who we can employ. The fact that that statement didn't come from John Skipper, I think now just looks even worse to me. The second thing is, it's been covered a little bit less, but in the Alabama rally, Trump said, you know, in addition to players not standing for the anthem, his other complaint was that football isn't violent enough anymore. That, you know, there are 15-yard penalties when you hit someone in the head, and basically that the players are all, you know, wimps and like the wussification of America and all that stuff. And that statement actually kind of gave the game away for me. Not that this is like a shocking conclusion, but that this is fan service. That Trump doesn't care about any of this stuff, that he's just saying things that he feels like white people in the middle of the country who feel like, you know, football players are rich and, you know, they're complaining and they're millionaires. And also they don't even give each other brain damage anymore. Like, what's wrong with this country? Like the fact that those two things were combined showed me that this has very little to do with his beliefs about patriotism and the flag. And it's just all about telling the people that voted for him what they want to hear.
I just don't understand why nobody can get this dude to shut up. Like
Marcus, John Kelly is getting the White House on lock, man. It's everything's in order.
he's like, he, it's so self-destructive. It's like, I mean, nobody can get him to chill. Like, just chill. We're just talking about football, right? We're just talking about, like, NFL players. Like, somebody needs to get him to chill in foreign relations, and they can't do it. Like, you know, we're about to be in a nuclear war because this dude can't control his mouth. And it's insane. It is insane that the president is like my uncle who drinks a little, you know, a little too much and probably has an old heroin addiction, right? It's like he and my uncle are the same. I can't even wrap my mind about right. how crazy
he's,
that is.
He's, you know, he's Donnie from Queens calling into WFAN. He's the dipshit at the end of the bar. And there's no rhyme or reason here. And we've known this for, you know, some of us who lived in New York in the 1980s and 90s have known this for 30 years. He's just a guy with a mouth. What's interesting about the NFL piece is that for all that we, as you guys just both articulated, that there's no rhyme or reason to anything that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth. There's no greater strategy here appealing to some base. It's just bullshit, right? But there is a history with the NFL. You know, through all of those decades when banks and cities and media and elected officials, all these people were enabling Trump's businesses and his personal bullshit, only the NFL told him to fuck off. And the first time they did it was in the 1980s when he owned the New Jersey Generals and the USFL, and he pushed the USFL to move to a fall schedule to pressure the NFL effectively to give him a franchise, and then sued the NFL on antitrust grounds and ran the USFL under. And then more recently when he tried to buy the Buffalo Bills and was laughed out of the room. So there's history here, and whether it connects to the, you know, 17 tweets about the NFL that he's emitted up until we started taping the show, I don't know, but there is history here. So if the NFL were taking some sort of moral high ground by attacking Donald Trump, it certainly was, you know, was in a position to do so given their past relationship.
Meanwhile, they've also given him like what, $15 million, like on his campaign. He's a piece to them, right? He's just a cog. One thing the NFL, like, and they know this, you know, even though they probably cowtailed in this PR situation here, they know they're bigger than the president. Like, people are going to ride with the NFL over the president all day, every day. And they know this. It's the arrogance of the NFL. So I feel like Trump is just the cog for them. Like, yeah, we'll give you some money. We need somebody in this spot right here. But in the end, dude, like, we will shut you down. And they're showing that, like, even we will even contradict ourselves and ride with players. But you're not going to beat us. And he's got, like, he's got homies who are, like, owners. And he's choking it with them. This is the crazy part. Like, Robert Kraft is with him. And he's pushed him to the brink. That's the part that's so amazing, that he has so low, like, temperance that he's pissing off his friends, his guys, who have to be like, man, dude, you're killing me. I have to put out a statement against you, even though you're my guy and I'm giving you money. Like, that's how wild he is.
Rex Ryan, I think, came off particularly badly in this whole episode. You know, you mentioned Shad Khan and a couple of the other owners who gave Trump $1 million for his inauguration and now seem upset with him. Rex Ryan goes on the ESPN pregame show. Rex Ryan, who introduced Trump at a rally and who owned up to that fact and his little soliloquy, but now says, "I'm pissed off. I can't believe that Trump called players sons of bitches." Well, you know, I guess it was cool when he called, you know, Mexicans coming across the border rapists. Like, you know, that was fine. But if you call, like, NFL players sons of bitches, then that crosses your red line, Rex Ryan. I mean, I think, you know, good for owners or commentators for getting religion at this point, I guess. But, you know, people need to have empathy. Like, people need to understand that when, you know, the most powerful guy in the world or a candidate for the presidency is saying really awful stuff about people who are voiceless or who are less powerful, that, you know, maybe he could say that about somebody that you know or that you care about at some point. Maybe, you know, you shouldn't empower somebody who makes statements like that. I don't know. That seemed pretty obvious to me, you idiot Rex Ryan. Jesus Christ.
And that's that's like the foundation of it all, right? Like, first off, congratulations, Rex Ryan, like, has a soul. So we learned that, and, you know, I applaud him for, I wasn't sure before that, but all of this is about lack of empathy. All of it, the fact that it's being dubbed an anthem cause, an anthem protest, shows right. that, like, people, yeah. they don't care about what the actual cause is, and the point is, and I know he lashed out, and he had pig socks and all that, the bottom line is, and I've talked to Kaepernick plenty times about this, the bottom line is, he's hurting about what he's seeing. Like, that's what this all is. It's about this sorrow you feel as someone who has made it, someone who is successful, and you feel bad because you're in this spot, and people are hurting, and it hurts you. Right. I know the feeling. I went to college and my family back at home is struggling and people hungry and I'm in college chilling and you feel bad. Right. Like, that's how. So he was just hurt. He's hurting. And the answer is, dude, can you please stand for the anthem? And nobody's acknowledging the fact that Malcolm Jenkins is hurting, like Michael Bennett. These are hurting people who are seeing what's happening. And all people care about is the how they lashed out, so to speak, or how they went about showing you they hurt. And that's the part that really gets me about, you know, the Tom Brady's and the Drew Brees, is, you know, like, you know, you're big on this team deal, but hey, there are teammates over there hurting. You should probably go do something about it. And we've seen some players who said, hey, my guy is hurting. That's what the Mark Conner from the A's saw the catcher wanted to kneel. And he's like, all I know, when he was talking to us and he was getting choked up, I saw that guy needed a brother today, so he puts his hand on the shoulder. Empathy is at the core of it, and we've seen how much it's lacking.
I think a really important thing to talk about today and this week and next week is Marcus mentioned Malcolm Jenkins, who, you know, for all the criticism of what is it they're even protesting? We don't even know what they're protesting. Malcolm Jenkins, along with Anquan Boldin, has, you know, he made a video for Sports Illustrated, and he has talked relentlessly about the very specific issues around criminal justice, bail reform. Like, he's supported specific legislation and policies around what he wants to see around policing, particularly with people of color and mass incarceration. And Stefan, the fascinating thing here is, and Michael Bennett too, like, talking about an extremely specific set of issues relating to what happened to him personally in Las Vegas. So I felt like this specific core, this set of players, was drilling down and making this protest about something specific. Then Trump comes in, and now it's about the players versus Trump. Now it's about the players versus the anthem and players versus the flag. And for all that's good about, you know, I think you mentioned 150 players that are making this statement, it becomes less specific of a cause, right? And so, you know, where do you think it goes from here vis-a-vis, you know, what Colin Kaepernick was talking about and what Bennett and what Malcolm Jenkins are talking about?
And this is where I think it gets really interesting, and it falls back on the NFL to take further action. A couple of days before all of this went down, a group of current and former NFL players, including Jenkins and Boldin, wrote a 10-page memo to Goodell asking for league support and cooperation in a campaign for racial equality and criminal justice reform. So there is this document that's sitting on either Roger Goodell's desk or some PR guy's desk at the NFL with specific requests on how the league can help make this not about disrespecting the flag or disrespecting the military or disrespecting the anthem, but can take concrete steps to make its fans aware of why these African-American young men feel, as you said, Marcus, feel hurt and feel pain and want progress to occur, want change to occur. Here's a specific set of things that you, the NFL, can now do. Forget signing cap. This is the front office. This is the main NFL office. Can actually do something. So Stephen,
can we pause on this for a second? Just how remarkable this is that, you know, the president of the United States retweets some rando on Twitter, writes something just completely ignorant about Pat Tillman and the flag, just not understanding at all who Pat Tillman was and what he stood for
at all.
So this is the president of the United States. And as I said before, just seems to have no interest or knowledge in what's going on. And then on the other side, you have people like Malcolm Jenkins, who is an amazing football player, an incredibly smart guy, but is not someone who, you know, in his life has like, you know, he doesn't have the kind of like background or resume that you would expect for some to like stand up in terms of knowledge to like the president of the United States. And yet how seriously these players are taking it, the fact that they've developed this memo, the fact that they know an incredible amount more than many politicians or experts in the field now, just put those two facts alongside each other. And just the next time somebody says, what are they even protesting? Just like, just think about how remarkable this moment is in American history.
And it's like, this is the pathway. Bolden and Jenkins and even Josh McCown, they've been visiting Congress, you know, for about, and I know they went at least last year. Like, this is the new wave. Like, and we're seeing it like with a Steph Curry. They're just so willing to trade to cash in their fame, and they're so willing to trade in whatever influence they have, that if you get enough of them on the same topic, it's going to be hard to overlook. And I think that's what we're seeing. Like, and Malcolm Jenkins, Anquan Boldin, you know, they're great players. They're not even like the lit ones. They're not even the superstars. You know, I think that LeBron tweet was retweeted like 600,000 times.
You bum. Can we hear your thoughts about Steph, actually, Marcus? You wrote a book about Steph Curry, as we all know, and he's not somebody that you think of as being, you know, a guy that wants to make really provocative and out there political statements. And this was kind of thrust upon him around the Warriors, you know, not wanting to visit the White House. What do you make of how Steph has kind of been put into this maelstrom?
And let me just say, here's what Steph said. He said, by acting and not going to the White House, hopefully that will inspire some change when it comes to what we tolerate in this country, what is accepted, and what we turn a blind eye toward. It's not just the act of not going. There are things you have to do in the back end that you have to push that message into motion. That's not something that we've heard from Steph Curry before. He's not the most political guy, right?
No, he's not. And, you know, Steph prefers... He prefers the Malcolm Jenkins role, right? Where you sneak off and you're in Congress and you're like actually doing tangible things to affect change and not kind of in the forefront. Like, that's his whole thing is like, keep me. I don't want to be in a discussion. I don't want to be out front. I want to be in the back, like, you know, making things happen. But because of who he is, you know, because somebody wrote a dope book on him and he's winning championships and all that, now he's kind of like, he's got to say something. He's got to stand up. And I think what we've seen with this Trump situation is that he's just comfortable doing it now. He's like, all right, this is who I am. This is who I have to be. I used to be able to fly under the radar, but that's over. So here's how it's going to be. And the crazy part was the Warriors gave him an out. And he kind of is like, nah, let's get that out of here. Because they were going with the whole, we're going to meet and talk about it. We're going to give it the proper, you know, the dialogue and discussion. Bob Myers was intent on trying to figure out a way to make it happen. Steph's like, yeah, this is the company line, but nah, I just don't want to go, right? I mean, he made it clear. He ended all of that, like, I don't want to go. And that's Steph saying, all right, let's do it. Let's do it. You got me. And you know, you got LeBron. He's just like a symbol of how these athletes are starting to say, all right, we may not be Ali per se, but it's a whole lot of us who realize we got some clout and we can use it. And I think his friendship with Barack Obama helped him, right? Because he's like, yeah, I've already done that. I can call the president and go play golf. So I really don't have to worry about this dude at all. But man, I've never seen him this comfortable being part of a controversy. Like, yeah, I don't want to go. And not trying to curb his answer or qualify his words. He was like, yeah, no, I just don't want to go. I don't believe in this guy. And that was like, oh, wow. It was like he got the glow, you know, like all of a sudden the bullets slowed down and he realized that he was Neo. Like that, it was like that moment for him. Like he figured out, like, yeah, I don't care. I'm Steph Curry, and this is my message.
Well, the point here, right, is that even for a guy like Steph, this gets to the whole stick to sports thing, is that Trump has made it so that making no statement is a political statement. And you could make that argument in the past about Michael Jordan or whoever, but it's more true today than it ever was in the past, that, you know, the situation was thrust on him and thrust on the Warriors, that they had to make a decision. And going to the White House is not a neutral move at this point. I'm sorry, Pittsburgh Penguins, but, you know, there was nothing that Steph could do to avoid this moment. And I think he handled it well and gracefully. And the last point I want to make on this segment is, let's note that LA Sparks also stayed in the locker room in the WNBA finals during the national anthem. And the WNBA players,
the WNBA has always been in the forefront of this.
Yeah, they were there. Like, you know, Bruce Maxwell deserves a lot of credit, the baseball player who was the first. Mm-hmm. The WNBA players were, you know, some of the first in all of sports to speak up on racial equality.
Yep. Especially as a collective, right? Especially as, all right, let's all do this together. They've been the unified front on that end. From the beginning, way back, I remember with the I Can't Breathe. Like, they've been on top of it. And they definitely should get some credit for
and
that.
And they made a league change its policies. They wore T-shirts during pregame, were fined, talked to the league, and the league turned around and said, we're not going to punish you for silent, quiet protest. Before we get to the NBA, a heads up that on our bonus segment for Slate Plus members this week, Marcello Balboa is going to stick around and talk about the U.S. men's national team's precarious state in World Cup qualifying. Also going to ask him about the 1994 team's hideously ugly jerseys. If you want to hear that conversation, please join Slate Plus for just $35 a year. If you do, you can get a Slate tote bag plus bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week. Sign up at slate.com/hangupplus.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Well, Kevin Durant had an interesting week. First, Nike rolled out some new sneakers, the KD10 Finals, that seemed to be marketed at fans who embraced Durant's insecurities. Then Durant engaged with a Twitter follower on his personal account, but oops, responded in the third person and dissed his old team, the Oklahoma City Thunder, and their coach, Billy Donovan. And I didn't even realize that Durant had to apologize a few weeks ago for some comments he made about India, which he had visited earlier in the summer. Marcus, if you Google Kevin Durant apologized, you get a lot of hits. It seems like Kevin Durant is just kind of naturally insecure, kind of an insecure overachiever, which isn't a bad thing, but he does seem sensitive to what is going on around him, and it seems to be creating some distractions, shall we say.
It's crazy too, right? We're talking about Kevin Durant. That's the part that, like, if it were me, I'd be like, all right, yeah, that makes sense. But it's Kevin Durant. Like, that's the part that blows me away. Is not only is it Kevin Durant, it's Kevin Durant after answering every critic, after coming with the ultimate, shut up, I told you I was right. Like, he won the championship. He became the finals MVP. He's being anointed. And he still feels like, man, but that kind of sting, let me shoot back, right?
The soles of those Nike shoes, they include disses. I mean, literally written on the bottom of those shoes are like what Twitter bots write about him. Soft, super team, can't beat him, join him, arrogant, choked. They've got his stats from the 2017 finals and the team's 16-1 playoff record. That seems just a little bit weird. I mean, they won the damn championship and he was the MVP, Josh.
It's a little bit weird. Yeah, so the tweets that he was responding to was about him leaving OKC, and then his answer was about how he didn't like playing for Billy Donovan, and it was only him and Russ, and they didn't put the pieces around him to win a title. I guess the thing that was in, two things that are interesting there are like, hey, he was like being nice to Russell Westbrook. That's good. Maybe that'll help repair their relationship.
But he should have though, right? That's the part. That's what I wanted. I wanted to shout at Westbrook to amp this thing up.
I know. Yeah, that was a little bit disappointing. Do you think that Russ is like sitting there nodding, being like, yeah, that I think this this Durant guy is actually making some good points about what's going down in
absolutely,
Oklahoma
right?
City.
Russ is over there like, you better not have. He ain't ready for war. That's what I thought. That's what Russ is thinking.
Also, the language in those tweets, though, guys, was kind of remarkable. KD can't win a championship with those cats. I mean, who's he trying to channel, Marcus?
Oh, so look, here's a. I actually heard the explanation for this, and so the tweet posed a question: give me one reason why. Like, give me one reason outside of winning a championship.
Yeah.
You will, you know, leave OKC. I don't know if he necessarily knew or believed he was, you know, on a secret account, even though he clearly has those. I think he was like, all right, I'll answer this as a fan, right? Even though he's on his account, here are the reasons. Like, hey, KD, I think he was like kind of. He stepped in to be like this Twitter guy and was like, all right, I'll give you the reasons. He can't do this. He doesn't have this. He doesn't have this. Like, now, does that make sense? I think that's what he was doing. I don't know if he was necessarily thinking I'm on the secret account. That's the explanation I was given. And I kind of get how he could do that, except for the fact that he threw Billy Donovan under the bus. But it's all just crazy because he's Kevin Durant. He's the Finals MVP. Like, you just answered every critic. You just answered every tweet. So you don't need to go answer tweets anymore,
yeah,
because
you
have this little bitty trophy. Yeah, it's over. Everybody loves you now. Why are you doing this? But you know what? Having covered so many of these athletes and dealt with them, like, I really do mean this when I say it is refreshing that he's a human being. And you do get to see, first off, it just reminds you, like, sometimes you lose sight of it, but, like, dude is 28. Right. Right. Like, sometimes they get so big where you think they're 37 and they got the world figured out. You got to remember they're 25, 26. And these moments remind me, like, yeah, you know what? I got a little bit more wisdom than you. I've been around the block a few more times. Right. Like, he's 28. But also that dude, he's a guy. Like, he's a different dude because he just lets, like, he feels and he's like, all right, I'm gonna let it out. Where the rest of them are so, like, manicured and controlled and right. Buttoned up. Like, Durant's like, hey, man, this is me. I'm a little bit insecure. I'm insecure, and I want to clap back at people, and I want to defend my name, and I don't like being not liked. But I'm like, you know what, Durant? Yeah, you know what? Be you. Go ahead and be insecure. I appreciate that from you.
Right.
Even though you're Kevin Durant.
It shows that, look, he's not an alpha personality, and that's refreshing to know because they're humans. We want to believe that you don't get as good as LeBron or Kobe or MJ or KD through preternatural ability and this crazy inhuman desire, this drive. But that drive comes from somewhere. I mean, every star has a sort of MJ getting cut in the ninth grade from the basketball team moment in their past. Some of them repress them or move on from them, and some of them incorporate them into who they are.
Here's some thoughts. So, you know, like, when guys like LeBron, like, when it's going into the playoffs, will just performatively be like, I'm getting off social media. I'm going dark because I got to really focus, which means that I have to be thinking about basketball 24/7. And I couldn't possibly be, you know, scrolling through Instagram. I think that LeBron probably has some secret accounts where he's like, just, you know, browsing a little bit during the playoffs, you know, even when the main King James account is dormant. That's point number one. point number two is it's not like LeBron and other athletes who are really huge and maybe even bigger than Durant ignore slights. Like LeBron, he speaks out when like people go after him, whether it's about, you know, his relationship with Kyrie or whether it's political stuff, you know, as he did over the weekend. It's just that LeBron's battles, the ones that he picks, are a little bit bigger.
Just a little.
Just a little bit. And that, I think, is the kind of funny thing or the weird thing about Durant is that on the one hand, you know, all of the whole concept of bulletin board material and using perceived insults or real insults to fuel you is like a classic thing. We all know that's done. But the sort of like gives it empowers, you know, the trolls out there to think, you know what,
he might
respond.
I
can go after these guys and like they'll hear it and it'll like affect them. It's just weird that somebody could be as successful as he is, and you understand that he's fueled by slights, but slights this small,
right?
I think we're also seeing too, like the transition. I remember Draymond Green had to go through this. Draymond Green is like he's a guy from Saginaw, right? Second round pick. He still could walk around Target, and he likes that, right? He likes being connected to people. He likes being an NBA star who's kind of feet are on the ground. But then he got to a point where it's like he couldn't do that. And he learned because he had to slap somebody at hanging out at Michigan State because the dude wouldn't shut up, right? And it's like, hey, the message is, dude, okay, I know how you started, but you've gotten too big to just be hanging with the proletariat, right? Or, you know, with the regular people. I think Kevin Durant, the whole vibe in OKC was small town, one of the people. Right. And he likes that. He likes being kind of down to earth. And I think he's got to learn, like, man, you're bigger than that. Like, especially you're in this bigger market. Like, you may not be able to be with the people. Right.
You're not the runner up anymore. You're the champion and the finals MVP. Right? And you pointed out on your new athletic podcast with Tim Kawakami, he doesn't have a big entourage. He doesn't have a big stable of people. That's not him.
No,
he wants to be the people star.
Like, if you talk to Durant, like, I've never met a guy at his level who wants you to talk to him. Like, most of these guys, it's like you got to get through their people, right? And you got to figure out an angle to get their interest so they can talk to you. Like, Kevin Durant, when I first met Kevin Durant, he just wanted to talk, right? Like, he likes talking to people. It's one of the things that really jumped off the screen with him. Was like, yo, he just likes to have regular conversation. Put your recorder down, go talk to Durant. He's all in like that. He just likes it. He likes the community of it. And I think he's got to learn like, yo, I'm Kevin Durant. I'm the finals MVP. Like, I'm in the conversation, like, for top 10 players of all time. Like, he's kind of got to get that, man. I'm too good for this, and I don't know if he can get it, but like,
well those of us in the media, I mean, Marcus, you're going against your own interest there. You got to say, absolutely. like you know the thing that you need to do is just talk more, just tweet through it, man. talk through it. We'll get to the other side. But don't you think that a lot of what's going on here is that at a certain point, I think around when he decided to go to Golden State, but maybe a little bit earlier than that, he decided, like, actually, you know, being quiet or just saying, you know, the cliche, like, polite things is not just me. And like, I've been burned a few times, but I think the thing that is really my personality is just like being real with people and saying what it is I actually believe. You know, the podcast that he's done with Bill Simmons, like, he talks like very openly about like other players and other teams in the league, not in like a negative way, but in a very candid way that I think is unusual, and that I think that those of us who are fans and those of us in the media should be extremely grateful that for whatever reason, he feels like either he wants to do it, it's in his interest to be perceived as a guy who's just, you know, keeping it real, but that's just like part of who he is now. And I think it would actually be a negative thing, maybe for him, but definitely for us, if after this like ghost account, third, you know, Twitter issue, if he decides, you know what, the best thing for me to do is just like shut the whole thing down. That wouldn't be good.
No, it'd be terrible for me. But, you know.
Great tweets, Katie. Great tweets.
Keeping it real can't go wrong. So, you know, that's something you got to be careful of. Like, he already had to have a conversation with Steph Curry because he was keeping it real with his thoughts about sneakers and ripped Under Armour.
That's right.
You know, so it's like that's the part. I appreciate it. It is refreshing that Kevin Durant, you know, he's going to say what's on his mind and he wants to talk. I think it's refreshing that he can. He would love to go sit in Pete's and just have a conversation with a dude, you know, just a random. He would love to be able to do that. But, man, he's got to learn. He's Kevin Durant. I say get rid of the secret accounts, all of them, and just, like, be you from the KD Trey 35. Like, just if you're going to go in, go all in.
I also just want to add before we in the segment that I don't necessarily endorse Marcus's view of what happened with the Draymond Green at Michigan State. That guy, you know, you can't just go around hitting people. Even if
you can't, I know that's the point.
Even if they're just bending your ear and being annoying.
You definitely can't go around slapping people for sure.
Well, as long as KD can deal with Joel Embiid subtweeting him, I think he'll be okay. Joel Embiid is better than MJ ever was, Embiid tweeted over the weekend. So I think that's going to be the standard to see whether KD can survive this.
Joel Embiid is one of these guys who might end up like Kevin Durant, where it's like, all right, dude, you're too big. It's time to stop, you know, but you got to push off the Twitter buffet.
Josh Levine is the editorial director of Slate. Josh is going to leave us at this point in the show. Josh, thank you for coming on.
Been a pleasure, Stefan, as always.
He will be back next week, everybody. Marcus Thompson is a senior columnist for The Athletic. He's the co-host of a new podcast for The Athletic called Warriors Plus Minus, and he is the author of Golden, The Miraculous Rise of Steph Curry. Marcus, thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate you for having me. Anytime. I'm going to take a knee somewhere.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
In Atlanta on Sunday, 43,500 people turned out to watch Atlanta United FC beat the Montreal Impact 2-0. The expansion team is leading Major League Soccer in attendance. It drew a league record 70,000 plus crowd earlier this month, and a crazy, unexpected pro soccer culture has bloomed in the South. Marcelo Balboa earned 127 caps with the national team, played in 3 World Cups, played in MLS from its start in 1996 until 2002. He's now a broadcaster for Univision and the Colorado Rapids and a coach with a Rapids youth team. And he's here with me now. Marcelo, thanks for coming on the show.
No problem. Anytime.
Atlanta United, Marcelo, is playing in this new $1.5 billion Mercedes-Benz Stadium, the home of the Atlanta Falcons. Jimmy Carter was at the team's first game there. You attended the record game, which you called for Univision. First off, what was the atmosphere like?
You know what? It's probably one of the best I've seen.
Wow.
I mean, it's different. I mean, if you want to compare it to Seattle and Portland, I think it's different because this was a indoor. The roof was closed. 70,000 people. People were screaming and yelling and cheering, and just a completely different atmosphere. But it was a special day. I'll say that. It's nice to see, because when you talk about MLS and where you would like to see the future of MLS be, that is the future of what MLS. We want MLS to be.
It's kind of amazing because, you know, I grew up in the 70s in New York. I went to a bunch of New York Cosmos games at Giants Stadium when they were drawing 76,000 fans. And still, through all of these years, through the decline of the North American Soccer League and through the rise of Major League Soccer and the growth that the league has experienced, both in terms of attendance and in terms of getting soccer-specific stadiums in places like Colorado and New York and all over the country, the thought of like 70,000 people going to a domestic league soccer game in the United States still seemed kind of far off to me.
Well, you know, it happened before, right? It happened back in the old NASL days.
Right.
And I think that soccer has grown so much since, we're talking the 60s and 70s, and it's the number one sport that the kids play between the ages of 5 and 15. So I think this next baby boom generation is starting to realize what soccer is. You know what I mean? It's taken a while. It's the most popular sport in the world. Look at all the ethnic backgrounds we have here in the United States. And anywhere in the world, soccer is number one. So it's just a matter of time, I think, before it really took off here in the United States. And let's be honest, it probably scares the crud out of NFL.
Oh, I hope it does.
It probably scares baseball. It scares hockey. That's why they put it down so much. The fact that now you're starting to see NFL owners owning teams, putting stadiums up because of the fact they see the potential of what the world game is. Because let's be honest, when you talk about being world champions, there's only one tournament that I know of that's a professional tournament that you can be considered the World Cup, the world champion, is when you're playing the other country. Now, so I think a lot of people freak out about that.
Yeah, and you make a really great point there about the NFL. The owner of the Atlanta Falcons is the owner of Atlanta United. And this stadium was designed with soccer not as an afterthought, as I understand it. It was created so that it looks like a smaller soccer bowl when you cover the upper deck. But when you cover the upper deck, historically, you know, teams would roll down those plastic tarps and it looks really jerry-rigged. But in this place, these are like mechanical curtains come down and then you open the roof and it looks like a bowl. It looks like a smaller European-style 40,000-seat soccer stadium. So bigger than what we're traditionally have come to believe is the right size for an MLS team, for a US team. So a little bit bigger than that to accommodate. But then even when you want to get to that larger stadium, it's there. So the foresight in designing the stadium seems really impressive to me.
I agree. I think you go from the first soccer specific stadium in MLS, you look at Columbus Crew, and then you look little by little up all these wonderful stadiums that have been put up all over the place, from Orlando to Sporting Kansas City to Colorado. And then you have owners who see a different potential. Atlanta United built that stadium with in mind it's going to be shared football, soccer, specifically for those two. So I think there's just certain areas and communities. I mean, let's be honest. Who would have ever thought that Atlanta was going to put 70,000 people in for a regular MLS game? Nobody. I think it surprised them how much excitement Atlanta United has brought to that city. So, again, I still think that we're in the right. The important thing for MLS is the foundation. The foundation has to be strong. So our foundation is 25,000 to 30,000 seat stadiums. That's what we're looking to fill. Right. You got to have in the league, you got to have one or two, maybe three stadiums that have the capacity to go to 50, 60 so you can play bigger games there. So listen, I think that everything that's been done, the commitment by the owners to build these stadiums, the commitment from these owners to see, and this is why they're billionaires, is because they see the potential of what soccer has, so they want in.
You know, let's also note that municipalities contribute a lot to these stadiums getting constructed, and that's a whole separate conversation about the propriety of, you know, cities kicking in as much as they have to kick in here. But once you get to that point, that you acknowledge that they're going to get built, and whether it's for the Falcons or for Atlanta United or for some college, you know, they're going to get built. So when let's look at those arenas, and you know, the one thing that's still kind of troubles me, and I'm sure it does you, is that when I turn on a game from Seattle or Portland or Atlanta, and I see them playing on field turf, and I think, why can't? I mean, these are, like you said, these are billionaires. And look, MLS franchises aren't NFL franchises, but why can't? Yep. Why is it so hard to have grass fields like they do in Europe? Is it that challenging? And do you think that needs to become a better priority, a bigger priority for the league?
Listen, I just think that when you have double occupancy in a stadium between football and soccer, and you're sharing a stadium, the abuse that the natural grass would take, and the rain, and the way you would tear it up, it would just not conducive to what we want to play and the style of soccer that we want to try to create here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean,
so I understand. In certain stadiums, you got to have Seattle, because of all the rain, with all the wear and tear, you have to have the turf. I get that part. And I think they're doing a better job of eliminating turf, those kind of turf fields. But on the other hand, I'm going to say this. You got to give credit to a lot of these companies, because the turf that's in Atlanta, I tell you what, I walked on it. And I thought, man, this is better than some of the fields that I've played on that is hard as a rock, that's bumpy. And what Atlanta's got there is fantastic. So, and again, there's not that many left out there. I get, you know, the Seattle, the Portland, there's still a few that are out there. But again, I think that's just the environment. And that the city has, you know, with all the rain.
Sure. And I think you have to be willing to sort of give, you know, you take what you can get, right? Everything's not going to be perfect in the first 10 or 20 or even 30 years. MLS is now 20 years in. The league must feel like a alien place from the one that you played in when it debuted. Compare for me the atmosphere and the playing conditions for players back when you started versus where we've come today and where you feel the league still needs to go.
Compare. I think it's almost unfair to compare.
Yeah.
And only because when we started the league, we all came back. I was playing in Mexico. Guys were playing in Spain and Germany and all over the place. And we came back to help start a league. We came back knowing that there was funding for 3 years, because they made it very clear to us that there was going to be funding for 3 years. So the first year, I think the atmosphere was really good, only because of the fact when the league started the first few months is because everybody wanted to see what MLS was. You know, the fans, you go to certain places, DC always had a great crowd, right. You know, Colorado here, we had a good crowd. And I think little by little, as time went on, you know, people just kind of said, oh, it's summertime. It's hard to watch, you know, a 2 o'clock game, a 1 o'clock game. So like any business, like any league, you got to find the tweaks and figure it out. But initially it was good. You know, I think the concept of MLS coming to the United States, they wanted to compare it to what the old NASL was, and they wanted to compare it to other leagues around the world, which I think is a little unfair. But, you know, the second, the third, the fourth year, it kind of dropped. It kind of dropped because I think people realize now that there's a league, they want to see a little bit more talent, you know. And it didn't help that after the 98 World Cup, the U.S. didn't do what we didn't do well. So people started comparing national team games and national team World Cup games to MLS. And they started comparing the money that the EPL spent compared to MLS.
Sure.
So I think the U.S., the MLS went through a lull. But here's the best part is they never broke and they never cracked. People kept on supporting it. It kept on supporting it. And we knew eventually that it would turn around. with more money. And we knew as time went on that soccer is a big enough sport that it would succeed. It was just a matter of how much money were the owners willing to put to bring players. And if you look over, and just go back now over the last 8 years of the money that owners are spending, I mean, to bring guys in like a Michael Bradley, a Josie Altidore, to bring guys, you know, never in our life did we think that a guy like Tom Dwyer in interleague change would be worth $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. So that's the point where we're at. The atmosphere now is absolutely ridiculous when you go to certain stadiums. It's like being in Europe. And I think that's kind of the model of where we're starting to go. We're starting to move. And again, listen, you got to take out some of the grandfathered initial inaugural franchises.
Yep.
They've been going at it for a while. They've had to correct a lot of mistakes and try to reroute it. Sporting Kansas City's done a great job with that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, again, it's just the atmosphere to compare back in 96 when we just had the World Cup and people were trying to figure out what soccer was starting to become in the United States. Mm-hmm. To now, let's be honest, no matter what channel you put on, be it Univision, be it ESPN, be it Fox, be it anywhere in the world, you can catch an MLS game now.
And I think what's really interesting, what you just said, Marcello, is the way atmospheres have been created at stadiums. I mean, Atlanta seems pretty raucous. I mean, they've created a tradition. You know, they've got this golden spike that they hammer in, and Arthur Blank, the owner of the team, hammered it in at a game the other day. So you're starting
Timber
to see
Joe the, with the saw in Portland.
Yeah, with the saw in Portland. That's kind of awesome. I love that. That's fun. And the corollary, though, has to be, and we're starting to see this, team owners, as you mentioned, being willing to spend. And the one thing that Atlanta has done is spend some money. They brought Brad Guzan back from England after a long career there. They've brought in some Argentine, other South American and Central American players that are at the top of their games. This is a good team.
They're a very good team. With Almiron, with Martinez. I mean, you bring in American players that fill in with Larenowicz, Brad Guzan, Michael Parkhurst. They did a nice job. They did a really nice job. And this could be one of those franchises like we saw back with Bob Bradley in Chicago that in their first year could make a serious run at an MLS Cup. I mean, they're young. They're exciting. They're dynamic going forward, which is ridiculous, the counterattacks they hit teams with. So, listen, I wouldn't be surprised if this is a team that can win. I mean, they'll be in the hunt for an MLS Cup in a big way with Toronto on the east side and the Red Bulls in Montreal. I mean, let's be honest. This is a team that was built to win this first year with the money that the owners spent.
Well, and I think that's the trend line that we got to watch going forward in MLS, Marcello, is are more owners and will the league be willing to allow greater spending to lift the overall quality of the sport, particularly as more cities seem interested or are interested in getting franchises. You've got Cincinnati that draws 30 plus thousand for a second division team. Do you see MLS being able to thrive with 30 or more teams, or do you think that we need a more European-like structure going forward as more cities want to get in the game?
Here's the deal. I mean, when you talk about Europe, there's only a few teams that make money. Let's just be straight up and honest. I mean, we see all the fun side of it. We don't see the financial side. The structure and everything is different. Listen, I think the biggest question is, will MLS eventually go to the European calendar, correct?
Right.
That's a huge one. And I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I think eventually we're going to have to. But I don't know if we're there yet. I don't know if on a February day when it's 24 degrees in New York or in Chicago and it's windy, that a lot of people are going to go. And I think that's where you have to be careful a little bit right now. I think you've got to keep building momentum. You've got to keep building the sport to that point where the passion, I mean, there's so much passion there. But to take a 10-year-old kid when it's 28 degrees or 24 degrees and it's snowing is different.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a league that's got 22 years of existence. compared to European leagues, Mexican leagues that have more than 75 years of existence and culture. So I do think eventually we're going to have to move to that, but I don't think that MLS is ready for that calendar change yet.
Marcello Balboa is a broadcaster for Univision and the Colorado Rapids of Major League Soccer and a former member of the U.S. national team. Marcello, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Anytime, buddy, anytime.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when he did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And now it is time for After Balls. Well, actually, After Ball, because it's just me. And since it's just me, I get to choose the name, and I'm definitely going to honor the rookie place kicker for the Philadelphia Eagles, who nailed a 61-yard field goal as time expired to beat the New York Giants 27-24 on Sunday. His name is Jake Elliott. He's from Illinois. He went to college at Memphis and was drafted by the Bengals. According to his wiki, Elliott began playing football in high school when an assistant coach noticed his talent at a homecoming contest. Here's what he had to say after kicking the seventh longest field goal in NFL history in just his second game.
In pregame, we kind of go over it and just kind of how I'm feeling during my warm up and what in the normal course of a game where I would feel comfortable at. But you know, given that situation, I kind of just ran up to the coaches at the end and just kind of prayed and asked for a chance there.
He prayed. He was rewarded. His prayers were answered. This is my Jake Elliott. It's already been a huge season for the one beacon of light in these dark times in the NFL. I speak, of course, of Scoregami, the imperfect name that SB Nation's incomparable John Boyce has given to the phenomenon of first-time final scores. Final scores, that is, that over the course of a century and more than 15,000 NFL games have never occurred. This season began with 407 unattained scores of up to 50-50, which was an increase from when Boyce came on the show last December because, thanks to Boyce, Pro Football Reference added to its list of missing scores games in which the losing team scores 1 point, which, as Boyce discussed, is indeed possible, when the winning team scores 6 or 8 or more points. But back to this season. We are down to 405 missing scores. Yes, the first 3 weeks of the regular season have yielded 2 scoregamis, both involving the Los Angeles Rams. In week 1, the Rams beat the Colts 46-9, and on Thursday night, they beat the 49ers 41-39. And it just dawned on me that a better name than scoregami might be scoregasm, because everyone is definitely exciting. I will leave that up to the people. But there is even more huge news on the scoregami front, and that is the debut of the scoregami Twitter bot. The bot, which you can find at NFL_Scoregami, updates every game in real time with the percentage chances of it ending in Scoregami. It is the brainchild of Dave Mattingly, a 36-year-old technology director at an online gourmet food retailer who lives in Old Forge, Pennsylvania. He's got degrees in computer science and math, as you probably would guess. Mattingly told me in an email that he wasn't a Scoregami aficionado until he read Boyce's story. After the Rams-Colts milestone, he wondered, at what point in the game did Scoregami become likely? If you knew that, you could also figure out the chances of Scoregami at the start of any game and the most likely Scoregami remaining out there during a game. Mattingly devised a calculation, plugged it into Excel, formalized an algorithm, and built a bot. He tested it during week 2 during the 1 o'clock games, and then he unleashed the bot on Twitter for the 4 o'clock games. I'm biased, But this is genius. The bot live tweets a game's Scorigami chances after every score and at the end of every quarter. It is, as you would hope, informative and deadpan. After Atlanta went up on Green Bay 34-10 two Sundays ago, the bot reported, "This game has an 8.13% chance of ending in Scorigami, most likely Scorigami 51-13, 0.48%. When the game ended 34-23, it reported sadly, "No Scorigami. That score has happened 12 times before, last on January 3rd, 2016. And when Scorigami does happen, well, the bot gets pumped. That's Scorigami! Exclamation point, exclamation point. It gushed after the Rams 49ers result. It's the 1,033rd instance of Scorigami in NFL history. Mattingly admits that the bot does need some tweaks. It thinks that every game starts with a 4.4% chance of Scorigami, which translates to 11 Scorigamis a season, which even though we've had two this year already, it does seem kind of high. He also wants to adjust the bot's assumptions about the independence of scoring events and factor in some game strategy. For instance, when the Rams were ahead of the 49ers 41-33, the bot reported that the most likely Scorigami would be 41-40, failing to understand that there was zero chance that the Rams would have kicked an extra point in that situation after a touchdown. That game, though, was a Scorigami watcher's dream. For the first three quarters, the Scorigami chances were low, 5 to 8%. Then, with 12:50 to play in the fourth quarter, the 49ers missed an extra point, making the score 34-26, and the chances climbed above 10%. When the Rams scored to make it 41-26, Scorigami chances went over 20%. And when the 49ers answered to make it 41-33 and crucially missed the extra point, we were on, in Mattingly's words, Scorigami red alert. Not because of that score, it had happened in 1954 and 1960, but because of what could have happened with some highly possible scoring plays. Scorigamis of 44-33, 41-39, and 41-41 all were in play. When San Francisco scored with 2:13 to go and again missed the extra point, the chances of Scorigami skyrocketed to 93%. That was inflated because the bot thought 41-40 was a likely Scorigami. In any event, the Rams killed the clock and preserved the 41-39 Scorigami, no doubt celebrating in the locker room not only their second win of the young season, but even more impressively, their second Scorigami. So thank you, Dave Mattingly, for giving me and countless others, well, we actually can count them, there are 2,049 Twitter followers for the bot as I speak. Thank you for giving us something to care about this NFL season. Please follow the Scorigami bot at NFL underscore Scorigami. That's NFL underscore Scorigami. That's our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup, and you can email us at hangup@slate.com. I'm Stefan Fatsis. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.